Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 5.3, Financial Crisis. Last time, we explored the end of the American Revolution via the Treaty of Paris. This treaty is, in the coming years and decades, going to lead to problems of its own. However, in the short term, those were not readily apparent. This week, we are going to continue our look at the events of the 1780s, which would help lead to the crisis of governance that would spell the end for the Articles of Confederation and necessitate the ushering in of the Constitution. The biggest crisis facing the United States during those early years largely centered around the faltering economy, something that we began talking about in episode 5.1. Today, we are going to turn back to that subject and look at the efforts by Robert Morris to stabilize things, as well as the effect of his newfound powers on the government. Robert Morris was busily working on trying to get his new national bank into place. However, as he toiled away on that task, he was dealing with unfortunate news from the French. All throughout the American Revolution, the French had generously given money to the Americans. It had been these lifelines that had helped float the government during those lean years of trade interruptions that accompanied the war. The states had not exactly been eagerly pumping money into the central government. Congress did not have any kind of taxing power, so they lacked the power to do much more than write some polite letters requesting the funds. Therefore, by the end of 1781, the French had largely become the main source of funding flowing into Congress. By the fall of 1781, the French were entering into a financial crisis of their own. Recall that last time we had brought up Morris writing to the French finance minister, Jacques Necker, who had recently been ousted from his job. France had spent an exorbitant amount of money on the war, and now themselves were struggling with their own solvency. As early as September 1781, Luzerne had informed Morris that the French court was done giving money to the United States. The Americans had, during the war, used France essentially as a limitless credit card, borrowing liberally. However, even as the Americans and the French were fighting side by side at Yorktown, Luzerne had informed Morris that he was to cease making drafts against his French line of credit, warning him that any future draft would be rejected. It goes without saying that this was a very serious problem for the Americans, who depended on the liberal lending policies of the French just to keep their heads above water. Morris would briefly catch a break when news of a French grant, worth 6 million livres, reached the colonies in conjunction with the news that John Adams had secured a $10 million loan from Holland, along with recognition of the United States in April 1782. At this news, Luzerne decided to go ahead and extend a line of credit to act as an advance for the incoming funds. Surely this was a safe bet for the French. After all, Luzerne knew that the money was coming. Unfortunately for Luzerne, this would end up biting him. Franklin, who, recall, was in Paris, for the opening of peace negotiations, had already accounted for much of the money coming from the French. Likewise, the loan from Holland, although looking promising, had yet to actually be funded. Slow travel times across the Atlantic meant that Luzerne was unaware of all of this, as Morris quickly depleted a line of credit that, unexpectedly, had little hope of repayment. Although this was a welcome respite for the Americans, it was not a sign of things to come. Luzerne stressed to Morris that the Allied victory at Yorktown marked a turning point in the war, and that it was time for the Americans to begin supporting themselves. The French ambassador argued that the king expected that after such a staggering victory at Yorktown, it was time that the United States began making an effort at self-reliance, letting Morris know that this position would not be changing. Luzerne took a slight stab at Morris and indeed the United States as a whole here, commenting that the lack of effort by the young nation at self-sufficiency made the French almost regret the victories that they had helped secure. With French funding no longer a reliable source of income, Morris and company had a daunting problem on their hands. With the French cutting off the United States economically, it was up to the government to figure out some way to keep everything moving forward. This would bring up several questions for the young nation, and would help expose some of the most serious flaws in the Articles of Confederation. Part of the problem was that Congress did not fully understand the scope of the problem. Now, to be more specific, what Congress knew is that they had a serious lack of income and a whole mountain of debt that they had accumulated during the war. What they did not know was exactly how large that war debt actually was. Some of this debt was easy to account for. The United States knew how much money they owed to the French and now the Dutch. They knew how much they owed to those large creditors and how much they had paid for those big-ticket items. They had at least a pretty good guess of how much money they owed to institutions like the Continental Army, which is a subject that we are going to address much more next time. The problem was in amounts owed to individuals as a result of wartime requisitions. Way back in episode 4.49, when we were discussing the conditions during that winter at Valley Forge, we talked about how George Washington understood the critical importance of public relations. This was a war that was being fought over the question of government's ability to come and take your stuff. Washington understood just how poor the optics would be if he marched into some Pennsylvania farmer's land and just carted off all the food and cattle to feed his legitimately starving army. Wanting to save himself from this public relations catastrophe, Washington instead issued IOUs, promising that the Congress would make the now annoyed farmers whole again. The problem was that there was anything but a uniform way of carrying out this task. It was not always clear what was owed. Sometimes these farmers would receive official certificates that entitled them to reimbursement. Sometimes they were given some kind of paper currency which had, by the end of the war, depreciated to the point of being nearly worthless. Sometimes these certificates came scribbled on some scrap paper. Sometimes the claims were made without any kind of proof at all and were rather based on just testimony alone. People saying, yeah, I gave a few cows to the Continental Army that one time. You know, back then. Either way, after the war, a whole lot of people came asking about those promises to make them whole again for their wartime sacrifice. With no central method of actually documenting such things, a fair number of people likely attempted to create their own slip of paper saying that the government owed them something. With no real method of verification, the system was ripe for exploitation from those more unscrupulous citizens. But really, what could the Congress do about it? Not that any of that even really mattered, because the real headache here came from the fact that even if they wanted to act, it is not as though Congress had the money to do so. Potentially the biggest problem with the Articles of Confederation is just how dependent it left the federal government to the whims of the states. We are going to spend more time in upcoming episodes discussing how there would be some nominal moves towards a more powerful federal government, even during the Confederation era, in an effort largely led by Robert Morris. However, no matter what Morris did, the fact remained that the national government was pretty much subjected to the whims of the states. Nowhere was this more of a problem than in the world of finance and the national economy. As we have talked about before, the Congress lacked the ability to pass taxes, which, considering their very significant debt, was a pretty major problem. If Congress needed funding, they had to request that the states provide the funding and then largely cross their fingers that the states would actually deliver. As the Battle of Yorktown was ending, and the Americans were celebrating their biggest victory to date in the war, as we already know, the states themselves were drowning in crippling debt. The American Revolution had largely been a war fought over the question of taxation without meaningful representation. We spent 30 or so episodes talking about this in depth, so hopefully that is not something particularly surprising to you. It likewise should not be that big of a surprise that the population of the United States was distrustful over powerful central authority. They had every right to be. After all, they were literally in the middle of a war against the central authority of the British. For today, I'm keeping this discussion locked largely into the question of finances. But in the episodes to come, I'm going to be spending more time looking at the political ramifications of this relationship as we explore just how the central government could, or more properly couldn't, function when the states held nearly all of the power. In the event that the central government needed money, they needed to request those funds from the states, and it was up to those states then to raise the funds by taxing their own citizens. In theory, this meant that representation existed on a far more micro level than we are going to see in the future, as the citizens' primary representation came from their home state. The problem, as we are already seeing, is that this proved chaotic in practice and crippled the efficiency of the central government. At the end of October 1781, Congress made just such a requisition from the states to raise some much-needed funds. Now, historically to this point, Congress had not been terribly picky about how the states sent supplies to the central government. Sometimes the solution was sending along food. Sometimes they accepted piles of increasingly worthless continental currency. This request, however, was different. With the well quickly running dry between the United States and France, Congress needed real, actual money. This requisition required payment in either gold or silver, something that was in very short supply within the states. A request of this nature was going to require the states to turn around and pass new taxes on a population that was already feeling very overburdened from years of war. We are going to see later today how these new tax burdens after the war would lead to their own questions and would, in many cases, actually lead to debt relief through the use of devalued paper currency. We will get there in a little while, though. For now, the issue is that Congress needed money and was looking at the states to provide it. These new taxes were anything but trivial, and per historian Woody Holton, often ate up around 40% of people's income. Among the population, this tax was anything but popular. Our old North Carolina regulator friend, Herman Husband, wrote a pamphlet arguing that such high tax debt would force farmers to either forego purchasing tools for farming or would force them to sell the ones that they had. In the long term, this would hurt the farmers, which would, in turn, hurt the entire economy. We are going to, in time, return to Husband, because our radical friend is going to be involved in radical things down the road. However, the feelings being expressed here by Husband certainly were not unique to him alone. In addition to just telling the states how much money he needed, Morris also wanted to see a plan put in place that would have given the central government more ability to collect taxes. Now, part of this plan was the National Bank, which we have already talked about and are going to be talking about again later today. Another part was known as the impost. The impost was the idea that the states would, in exchange for the federal assumption of a portion of their war debt, grant the central government the power of direct taxation over the population. This would initially manifest through a tax on all imports being brought into the United States. The Articles of Confederation were very clear on the subject of the federal government having the ability to tax directly upon its citizens. It was an unambiguous no. However, growing wartime necessity had made everybody desperate to save themselves from catastrophe at the hands of the British. Now, because this is going to be an amendment to the Articles of Confederation, those same articles require that such an amendment be unanimously agreed upon by the states in order to pass. Morris hoped that if the amendment could be passed, it would mean that the United States would gain a nominal, though admittedly not huge amount of revenue. He viewed the far greater victory, though, in being that it would open the door for future taxes, which could potentially garner larger results. Morris got tantalizingly close to realizing this goal, too, as 12 out of the 13 states were on board with the impost. Only Rhode Island held out, which, if you have been following along with this podcast, is pretty much the most Rhode Island thing ever. Although all of the states, other than Rhode Island, would get on board with the plan, support did quickly begin to erode following the Allied victory at Yorktown. During the war, when the southern states were faced with the very real danger of having an invading army on their soil, they were far more receptive to doing anything that they could to raise those much-needed funds. However, following the victory at Yorktown, that all-important incentive of staving off annihilation at the hands of the British, very quickly subsided. Without that motivation, many of the southern states quickly grew lukewarm on the impost, realizing that with the diminished threat, it was not in their own best interest anymore. When Virginia revoked their earlier support for the impost, the proposed amendment was doomed. If the war had provided the desperation that Morris required to convince the states to give up a significant part of their own power, the outbreak of peace made them reverse course on the matter. For now, the impost was dead in the water. There will be an attempt to revive the impost down the road. However, before we can do that, we need to deal with the military and how they are playing into this entire equation, which is something that we are going to get to next time. Although the impost was dead, recall that Morris did come into his office with a handful of tools at his disposal. Specifically, through the use of the creation of a national bank, he was hoping to make lending easier and to help stabilize the very unstable currency. The bank was going to be able to issue notes and give revenue that would hopefully help stabilize the economy by providing Americans with the capital that they needed for expanding the economy. The hope was that in time, the bank would provide enough stability that the government would be able to issue a stable paper currency, something that had been absent for years, as runaway inflation immediately rendered any paper currency issued by Congress essentially worthless. The problem for Morris is that the task of finding funding for the bank proved to be much more difficult than he would have preferred. Morris was not entirely ignorant to the fact that getting the startup capital for the bank was going to be difficult, and set himself the relatively low bar of just $400,000. Morris worried that a failure to raise the necessary funds, which he fully believed to be higher than the $400,000, would kill the bank off before it could even begin. He was crossing his fingers that if the bank could just get its feet on the ground and show any modicum of success, it would prove to be an enticing enough prospect to raise additional revenue and expand the bank's lending power. In order to raise the necessary capital, Morris made a patriotic call out to the people to lend the bank the necessary silver and gold that it needed to reach the original funding goal. Morris was desperate for the bank's success because, really, he had few other options at the time. The states were not providing any money. France had cut up his credit card, leaving the bank as the only meaningful tool left at his disposal. The bank was attempting to build confidence among would-be users by convincing them that the bank had plenty of hard specie and could pay out notes on demand. It is the same concept as if you walk into a bank today and ask to take money out of your checking account. You are going to need a certain amount of confidence that the bank is going to say, "Okay, here you go," and then hand over the cash. The problem for the Bank of North America is that they did not actually have the necessary hard metal specie to do that. The bank tried all sorts of things to convince people that they had the money on hand, and for a short while it actually kind of worked. During the first half of 1782, the bank did actually help to float the government. However, it was largely a short-term solution. By the summer of 1782, the bank was dangerously overdrawn and informed Morris that they would have to stop giving advances until such a time that some of their debts were discharged. By 1785, the bank would be seen as an enemy by many. It was in that same year that the charter of the bank would be revoked. Among the biggest problems for the bank had to do with the debate over the use of paper currency in general. Paper currency has existed for a long time already in our story. We talked about it all the way back in the 1690s. It had at different times throughout the colonial era run afoul of British policy, becoming just another battle in the imperial crisis of the 1760s and 70s. During the war itself, Congress printed huge amounts of paper currency, which led to it becoming virtually worthless. When Congress attempted to remedy the problem by printing new money, it was also devalued to almost nothing nearly overnight. Congress had always been aware of the risk of runaway inflation from the use of paper currency, despite issuing huge amounts of it. The plan to deal with that involved the states retiring set amounts of it every year, or paying it back to the federal government, who would then retire it, thus limiting the supply as a hedge against inflation. The problem was that as Congress just kept pumping money out, the money-strapped states often failed to retire the money, leading to more rampant inflation as the colonial currency became more and more devalued. The fear among some of the leadership, including prominent men like George Washington and Henry Knox, is that through the devaluation of the currency, it would act as a form of debt forgiveness. If, for example, a debtor financed a construction project on credit for, let's say, $100. The massive devaluation of the currency would mean that the same debtor would now be paying a smaller percentage of the project's actual cost. As though to elaborate further on this point, historian George Van Cleve looks specifically at South Carolina merchant Henry Laurens, somebody that we spent some time with last week. Having been paid in that highly depreciated scrip, Laurens lost approximately 95% of the money that was owed to him. Benjamin Franklin believed that the use of paper currency could also be an effective way to help stabilize the post-war economies. Yet he also acknowledged that depreciation would benefit the debtor rather than the person who extended the credit. To this point, Franklin believed that the devaluation was a form of taxation, however, waved it off because it would only affect those wealthy enough to be making the loans in the first place. Those who supported the use of paper currency argued that it was a necessary evil. There was a lack of hard specie in the states, and paper money was required for the movement of goods. Furthermore, by using the paper money, it would encourage internal manufacturing growth, rather than forcing everybody to look abroad. There was almost a tacit agreement that paper money did favor the debtors over the creditors, yes, but that the alternative was going to be thousands of Americans losing their property and farms. In light of all the new taxes that people were being hit with, they were drowning in debt, and paper money provided something of a lifeline. Despite the feelings of men like Franklin that the effect of paper currency would only affect the wealthy, this proved to be little consolation to those creditors, who now felt themselves being cheated by the government directly. Now, this is all fine and good. Maybe paper currency was required in order to save the otherwise floundering economy, and to help pay the now large tax burdens that existed following the war, a burden that we are going to be talking about later on today. So, for now, just know that there was indeed a large tax burden. The problem, though, is that despite a vocal opposition to the use of paper currency at all, there were a whole lot of different places that said currency was emanating from. You see, it was not just Congress or a Bank of the United States that was issuing this currency, but rather the individual states had turned to its use as well. This on its face might seem surprising. We are used to a system today where only the federal government has the right to print money. The reason for that being a thing in the first place, though, stems directly from the crisis during the Confederation period. For the states, they were not out there trying to tank the fledgling national economy. But in many cases, it was just business as usual. We have talked before about how the colonies had been issuing various versions of paper currency for nearly a century now. By the 1760s, several colonies were issuing their own currency, and therefore took serious issue with the passage of the Currency Act in 1763, which was seeking to curb and phase out such practices. Debates over the use of paper currency became commonplace during the early and mid-1780s. Not just at a national level, but at the state level as well. All throughout the young nation, states had the same debates over the issuance of paper currency. Although there was generally broad support for its use, that was not necessarily the case in all areas of the country. In the South and in New England, it proved popular enough, although vocal opposition remained. In Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, there was strong opposition to the practice. In South Carolina, we see the use of a land bank situation. This is where the land itself was treated as the legal tender, rather than the actual paper currency. The idea is that landowners could use unimproved lands to satisfy debt. Well, this might sound great. The problem is that the government guaranteed the value of the land to be 3/4 of its appraisal value. The method did not take the actual market value into consideration, which means that so long as a landowner could get a generous appraisal for his land, it could be sold despite having little actual market value. The debtors in South Carolina hated absolutely everything to do with this plan, with Henry Lawrence lamenting that this plan essentially forced debtors to just forgive debts entirely. He pointed out that in many cases, creditors avoided bringing up the matter of debt out of fear that they were going to be forced into buying worthless plots of land. By 1787, this would lead many South Carolina merchants to stop paying their taxes because they were unable to collect sufficient revenue to do so. Making matters worse is that because all of the states were pretty much just doing their own thing, it made for a confusing number of laws related to debt collection. This had the practical effect of cutting off new streams of much-needed overseas investment. It is easy enough to see why. If you were a European creditor in, say, 1785, and somebody from the United States came seeking a loan, it was at the very minimum a hornet's nest that you did not want to step into. As historian Woody Holton puts it, critical overseas creditors were unwilling to touch American investments so long as overly cautious state legislatures feared the prospect of having indebted constituents. Creditors were none too eager to expose themselves to markets, where legislatures were coming down so heavily on the side of the debtors by accepting that worthless paper currency as legal tender. Holton further points out that this incidentally was a key argument against a Republican form of government. The fear was that the rural population could use their majority to force through laws that sought to directly redistribute the wealth from the wealthy creditor class to themselves through the devaluation of debts. In scope of the greater problem here, it probably should not come as a surprise that for the majority of farmers struggling to keep their farms, they viewed the problem through a completely different lens. In their view, the economic recession that dominated the mid-1780s came as a result of the extravagance and luxury that this affluent class was now living in. Well, they were struggling to just keep their farms after years of forced frugality. They were looking at a class of people that had speculated wildly during the war and had made a fortune while they drowned in debt and high taxes. They had very little sympathy to the plight of the creditors who grew rich in the face of their struggles. Right around this time, you might be asking yourself, wait, weren't we talking about the National Bank? How did we end up on this adventure into debates over paper currency? Well, I appreciate you all coming along on this tangent, so let's pull it all back together. The problem came in Pennsylvania, where in 1784, they were engaged in that same debate over the use of paper currency as a form of legal tender, as everybody else. The debate that formed in Pennsylvania focused on the question over if the government had the power to modify or altogether cancel existing contracts. In the scope of our current conversation, paper money was devaluing the claims by creditors, and therefore, as was being argued, it substantively acted as the government of the United States modifying the terms of an existing contract. The Bank of North America dealt primarily in short-term, low-risk loans. These short-term loans generally meant that farmers and smaller artisans did not have sufficient time to repay the loans under those short-term plans, effectively meaning that they were outside of the lending portfolio of Morris's pet project. Politically, this made the entire project increasingly unpopular. Critics were blaming the bank for sending up interest rates and for, self-servingly, sending specie abroad as it promoted imports rather than lending in such a manner to grow local manufacturing. The opposition argued that the bank was only really lending money to the wealthy, and that it was having the effect of cutting out the people in exchange for the promotion of an American aristocracy. In a time when paper money was broadly popular among the masses, the bank had become seen as the polar opposite of that. This all proved to be the breaking point for Morris's largest project. Pennsylvania revoked the charter of the bank in 1785. Following 1785, the bank would continue to exist as a private institution. Through a whole long series of mergers and acquisitions, the bank does remain today as a very small part of Wells Fargo. The financial situation in the United States was a mess. The French had completely cut off the Americans. The federal government proved completely unable to raise funds from the states, where the devalued paper currency was now acting as something of a de facto debt relief program for indebted farmers. Morris had tried, and failed, to set up an impost that would have granted the federal government some ability to directly collect revenue. However, the outbreak of peace following Yorktown had poured cold water all over this idea. There remains one aspect of the financial crisis that we have not yet looked at. Specifically, with the war over, the United States had an army that was still very much in the field and was getting really curious exactly where their money was. Next time, we are going to spend our time with the army as they inquire into when they were going to be getting paid. This will lead to some very tense moments as the entire situation threatens to spiral out of control. Until then, I hope you all have a fantastic 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as a clique of officers stationed in New York is about to get everybody feeling very nervous.